This week we're in Joshua. We're going to start in chapter 20. Now, 2 weeks ago, I wasn't able to be here. We attended a funeral for an individual on my wife's side of the family in Texas. 2 weeks ago was the video. 3 weeks ago, I wasn't able to be here. And then 2 weeks ago, we did the video. And I want to talk for just a little bit about the video and give you a chance to visit if you have things you want to bring from that video. I know I had misgivings to some extent about doing the video the way we did, but it's a two-hour video, well, not quite two, but almost two, so I had the challenge of trying to pick out the right section in there, and the title of the video is The Israelite, or The Israel Dilemma, and it's really intended and focused to address two issues, and I hope some of this came out, even though we didn't start right at the beginning. And really what it's addressing is, does Israel really have a claim on the land even yet today? And the other one is that Abraham, Isaac, the Exodus, the conquest, the establishment of the nation, all of those things are viewed by a large majority, even amongst Jewish rabbis, as inspired myths. That yes, it's inspired scripture, God wanted it written, but it's really metaphorical mostly. And not real events, not real times, that they would even go so far as to say that there was never this slavery time in Egypt, and we've talked about some of that before. But I was hoping that out of this you'd get a pretty good foundation for both of those things. I've had an individual that's not a churched person ask me, what's up with the people in Gaza and Israel and all that, what's going on? And you know, it's a wonderful opportunity that I probably didn't play as well as I could have or should have to explain what's going on in the world and how it fits in with the entire pattern of what God is doing from the moment of creation until today, and it's not complete yet. There's a new heaven and a new earth coming. I mean, that's a lot to try to lay out with somebody that asked a question that they looked for a 3-minute answer to. But nonetheless, it's there, and out of this video, I hope that you got a chance to see several things, both biblical and archaeological support in favor of both for believers, for people who trust the Bible, Israel's claim on that land even yet today, and how it was even prophesied, but also archaeological evidence that all of those things that have led up to today have great support even from non-biblical sources, archaeological things that we can find and see, and some of them even read, that talk about the house of David and all of those things. So that's why I brought that to you when I had to be gone. Did you have any comments or questions or thoughts as a result that you still remember yet today? I know this is a long time, 3 weeks, but anybody have anything from your own thoughts? Yes, sir, Dave.
Yeah, just as an additional source of information, this week Peter Gaiman, who's a professor at Shepherd's Theological Seminary, or Tanner went to seminary, got his degree. He's a graduate of the Master's Seminary. He has a podcast called The Bible Sojourner, and he just has outstanding podcasts, and he released a podcast this week, Are Biblical Israel and Modern Israel the Same?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's tremendous treatment from an hour on of that subject, which would really dovetail well with what we've been talking about in here. And just looking at the anti-Semitism rise we're seeing in the United States, even among supposedly right-wing political conservatives who are showing up, probably not, just very, very helpful.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you bring that up. It was easy growing up for me to develop such an appreciation that I still would stand by today as appropriate and valid for what the United States was and what it stood for despite all of its faults. I'm not saying it was a perfect nation or even necessarily all 100% God-based or even believer-based, but there was a lot. And there was a lot of uprightness and a lot of good things that went into the founding of this nation. And it was inconceivable of me that it wouldn't be that way forever. But it's not too hard to look now and see that all nations go the way of men. And it all centers around one key thing. Men are not willing to be governed by the God that created them. They don't want to be accountable to that God, and they will go to even totally illogical, self-destructive places and thoughts and concepts and actions to push God back. It's just so, that's the root of it. It's a God rejection that brings evil into the world. Yes, there are men that are quite evil, but, and so, it's hard for me when I think about where the world is going. David mentioned the so-called conservatives. You don't have to say just political conservatives now. The so-called Christians. There is an anti-Semitic rise in some Christian circles. Not circles that we would be thrilled to be part of, generally, but places you would never have expected it. Anyway, other comments, thoughts? Okay, one of the things that I would draw together from that are the foundations that God laid through Moses in his writing of those first five books. It's pretty amazing what's in there, its consistency, and how well it fits into God's establishment of a remnant all the way through. And that remnant becomes Israel for a period of time. And out of Israel, there's a remnant that continues through. All of our apostles, the 12, were Jewish men. And God did a great work through Israel in establishing the foundation for what would become our hope in Christ. So I've got, the whole thing is worth watching. As a matter of fact, I thought about not skipping the introductory piece, which we did skip in what I showed you, because that question, does Israel have a right to this land? And they've got quotes from Jewish leaders, including Benjamin Netanyahu, Menachem Begin. They interviewed them about that question, and that's captured and brought forward in the video. And Benjamin Netanyahu, I liked his question. Well, if Israel doesn't belong to Israel, why do the people who are English and live in England, the ones, the white people that are the primary people there, why do they think that England is theirs? They weren't the original. If you go back a few centuries, you got to go a few, it wasn't what we would now call the English people that had that place in England. They were a Roman heritage. And so there's some great thought-provoking things in there. If anybody wants it, I've got one right now because Derek still has the other, but I've got a copy of that video if you'd like to watch it. It takes a little time, but it's there. All right, I won't spend more time on that. Anything else? I will if you've got questions and comments. Yes, sir.
General prejudice against Semitic people in general. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting next to a Semitic person that went through the Assyrian genocide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's not a new thing. And why do they claim to represent the one true living God initially? Now it's a lot of other issues too. And honestly, I'll tell you that I believe this, but it's my intuitive belief, not my biblical belief. Okay. So I could be way off on this, but I really think anti-Semitism today, an awful lot of it is because of the prophecies and the scriptures that hold up the one true living God that said, I'm bringing them back. And a lot of those people aren't aware of it, but I think intuitively they know. It is Yahweh coming back, putting his things together and getting ready for the new kingdom, the new heaven and the new earth, in which they're not going to be a part. And so they, that, if you can't, I mean, what's the old thing in the business world? Hey, I'm just a messenger, don't kill me. Well, Israel, in a sense, is a messenger, and they'd like to kill the messenger. I don't know if you want to say it out loud, David, but I know you've got a thought. I just saw it. I went, whew. Okay, all right. All right. Let's move on. 3 weeks ago, we looked at Joshua 18 and 19. And in chapter 18, we saw they moved the base for their center of operations for the tribes from Shiloh to the tabernacle and the tabernacle to Shiloh. And it says the fighting died down. The conflicts, the active armed conflict was not going on. And so Joshua, in accordance with God's direction, continued apportioning the land. And the first thing he did was recognize the tribes need to complete the task of driving out the Canaanites. God told him that. But there were seven tribes that had not yet received their allotments. So Joshua put together a team, three members from each tribe selected by those tribes. And they were told to survey the land and come back with a written report that would divide it into tracts so they could then cast the lots to decide, let God decide through the casting of the lots who would get what territories. They completed that task and came back with a written report of the results. And so then there were, end result was they cast their lots, and it resulted in, resulted in the tribes getting their allotments of land, and it came out in some fashion in that general direction that we handed out. And so they all received their inheritance land, which meant it would stay with their tribe forever, years of jubilee. It would go back to the original families within the tribe and whoever would be there to inherit that. There were a couple of things that came out of that that were interesting. One is Benjamin, when they got their territory, some of it came from from Judah, and as a result, they now controlled the area that would be Jerusalem. It wasn't called Jerusalem then. Simeon got their land out of the central portion of some of Judah's territory, and Dan, the tribe of Dan, they weren't fully successful in getting their area fully conquered, and they felt like they were a little short. They went up into the area of Naphtali, up north of the Sea of Galilee, and they conquered a city up there. And it's not a big territory, it was a city. You'll see today, as we talk a little bit about something we're going to cover today, that sometimes the cities had villages around them, and so that was considered, you know, a part of it. So it might have been a bit of an area, but they renamed that area Dan. And so that's pretty much what we covered within those two chapters in a very small nutshell. And that's going to bring us to chapter 20. And I want to start out with the first nine verses in chapter 20. And we'll talk about that a little bit. And what we're going to see here is the establishment of the cities of refuge. So, chapter 21 through 9. Then the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, designate the cities of refuge of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the manslayer who kills any person unintentionally without premeditation may flee there, and they shall become your refuge from the avenger of blood. He shall flee to one of these cities, and shall stand at the entrance of the gate of the city and state his case in the hearing of the elders of that city. And they shall take him into the city to them and give him a place so that he may dwell among them. Now if the avenger of blood pursues him, then they shall not deliver the manslayer into his hand, because he struck his neighbor without premeditation and did not hate him beforehand. He shall dwell in that city until he stands before the congregation for judgment, until the death of the one who is high priest in those days. Then the manslayer shall return to his own city and to his own house and to the city from which he fled. So they set apart Kadesh in Galilee in the hill country of Naphtali, and Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah. Beyond the Jordan, east of Jericho, they designated Bezer in the wilderness of the plain from the tribe of Reuben, and Ramoth in Gilead from the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan from the tribe of Manasseh. These were the appointed cities for all the sons of Israel and for the stranger who sojourns among them, that whoever kills any person unintentionally may flee there and not die by the hand of the avenger of blood until he stands before the congregation. So in verse 1, we see God, Yahweh, coming back to Joshua and saying, now establish the cities of refuge that I told you about through Moses previously. And in that had been done back in Numbers and in Deuteronomy, God had said, we're going to establish these, and he laid out how it was going to work. And he also laid out the trial method that would be used in order to determine the guilt and the way it would work out for that person that caused someone's death without hating them or premeditating it. And we gave you this map some time back that had those cities of refuge on it. And you can see that they're fairly spread out. There's three to the west of the Jordan and three to the east of the Jordan. And so these became the places that you could go for a certain person that took a life without intention, and they had to flee. They had to get to those cities before the Avenger of Blood would take their life. Now, let's try to see if we can go back remember, what's the Avenger of Blood? Remember? It really wasn't spelled out in the scriptures a lot, but we know what that person's role was and so on. What was the Avenger's Blood's task? Yeah, basically it would be from within the offended family. They would select someone to go out and to take the life of the one who took the life of their family member. And here's a good question. The title is Avenger of Blood. On whose behalf is this avenger bringing vengeance?
God, because blood, the land is, I can't think of the word I want, but
blood that is shed inappropriately did bring the land into being, I mean, I can't say the right word.
Sorry.
But it's cursed. It was a curse brought on the land. And the correct answer does include God, certainly. I'm sure the family had some vested stake in that in many cases. They had angry, they wanted resolution, they wanted justice to be done, I'm sure. But I want you to go back with me to Genesis 9, verses 5 and 6. We are at the time that the floodwaters have receded. Noah is leaving the ark. And there were a number of changes that came about after the ark. One was the promise of God that we would that he would not again wipe out all of the air-breathing life through a flood. We get the rainbow. Another one is that certain animals were endorsed by God to be a part of the food chain for mankind. There's also a promise that the earth is going to yield forth its seasons and support the life needs for mankind in general going forward. But here's another one of the changes that occurs. Genesis 9, 5, and 6. Surely, this is God speaking to Moses, to Noah, I will require your life blood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man and from every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man's blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man. So this is something that God emphasizes and institutes as a stand-alone directive to the people, to Noah and his descendants, clear down through today. I think this, you could say this would be active, that when lifeblood of a man is taken, that there will be a penalty for that. And that penalty will be that the lifeblood of the one that killed would be taken as well. And God gave his reason for that. And what was his reason? What did we just read as his reason that this makes sense? God created mankind in his image, and so you are attacking the image of God when you take the life of another. Now, let's be very clear. As we come to it today, by today I mean in the time we're studying in Joshua, why did they need the avenging cities? If that's what's to be done, let's get an avenger of blood and just turn them loose. I'm sorry, cities of refuge. Sorry, words came out wrong. That happens more and more. I don't like it, but I can't seem to stop it. Why do we need the cities of refuge?
For accidental slaying.
Not all human-to-human death is murder. That's how we would say it today. God is saying there are times when people are going in their interactions with one another, a death may occur. And was that death intentional? Did it come out of hate? Was it premeditated? Those things get to be taken into account, just like they're taken into account in some of our laws today. Maybe not to the exactness or correctness of what we see here, but God said the avenger of blood is necessary and right, but here are the exceptions. You know, you did something that maybe was foolish, played a prank, I don't know what, but you did something and death resulted, and that was not your intent. It didn't flow out of your hatred, your intention to kill the person. And so here's how we're going to handle that so that justice, correctness, can come on top of this necessary point, because God made it clear. God could have said, back with Noah, if I see as God somebody kill another one, I'm going to sniff him right there. But no, God didn't say that, did he? He was very explicit. By whose hand was the one that took a life to have his life extinguished? You remember what it said? Go back there and look at Genesis 9 if you need to. Where was the source of the retribution, of the justice, of the execution of the one who killed another to come from? What's that? The hand of man. Why? Why was that be necessary, do you think, that mankind would be responsible to God for that action? Some of those questions aren't as easy, are they? If you could imagine with me for a moment a world where when a murderer murders, God just, you know, I don't know if it'd be lightning, fire, I don't know what he'd do, but he's gone. He would actually be depriving mankind of a piece of the teaching and of the worship of God that needed to go on. Mankind needed to own, along with God, the issue that this person was created in the image of God. I mean, after a while, who's going to be the bad guy? God, well, I didn't do it. You know, I didn't snuff out your family member. I wasn't the one that brought the sentence of death upon your family member that was a murderer. Or think about this for a minute. What if you have one brother kill another in the same family? What family is going to be responsible for selecting that avenger of blood? Wow. You know, that's going to start to be separating the real believers from the ones that are not so much believers. Because mankind within themselves are honoring God, recognizing God, recognizing that people aren't just born because of biology. People exist because God created man in his image. And because of that, man can't tolerate, if they're a follower of God, someone bringing intentional harm to the image of God and along the way violating one of the commandments. It's not okay. It's not going to be a part of our society. It's not going to be a part of our life. And so this avenger of blood was a very real thing and a very necessary part, or at least certainly a righteous, correct part of what God establishes within starting this nation. We're going to have refuges, cities of refuge, that you can go to so that if it was not murder in the sense of intentional murder, you can have a hearing and get justice. So what was supposed to happen when the person who caused a death, but it wasn't really murder, what did he have to do? Let's go through the steps a little bit. What? Well, he had to get there.
Give an account.
When he got there, what did he have to do? What's the first thing he has to do before entering as he's entering the city? He's going to talk to the elders. Where will you find them? At the city gate. That's where the official business was done. And this guy comes running up and goes, there's a guy after me. I need to tell you very quickly what the problem is. Okay? And he lays it out for them. Then what do they do? Well, they let him in, unless it's obvious that, I mean, it doesn't say anything about doing this, so I'm not going to add it. They bring him in, and they provide a residence for him. He's got a place to live, and he can live there until what?
The high trial.
Nope. There's a step in between there. The people of the town hear the case, and they have to decide. They have to either agree with this man that this was an accident or not. And if they agree, then he's allowed to live, but there's still some consequences in a way. Where can he live? Within that city's limits, however that was demarked by the Israelites in that time period. I think these were mostly fortified cities. There was a gate, right? That's where he goes to. What happens if he decides, I want to go fishing, and there's no good fishing inside the city limits? And so he grabs his rod and his reel, and he's out there catching trout one after another. Now what? If the avenger of blood finds him, he is really instructed to take his life. So this is a bit of a limited existence. Dave just preached on this not long ago, right? And did a great job, and I'm embarrassed to be trying to compete with that. I'm not competing with it, but go back and listen to that sermon. I'm sure there's lots of good things in there I'm not even going to think about this morning. But here is the situation. That's where he is. What if he had family? What if he had crops in the field? What if he had, and you can go down the list, that's another life. That was before I showed up at this city of refuge, because now I'm here. Until when? Until the high priest, that's the high priest when he entered the city, dies. And then what's his status?
He's free to go home.
He's free to go home. And that works out. And you could look at that different ways, kind of a modified time frame for prosecution. You know, the date's gone by. You can't be prosecuted for that anymore. So you could look at it that way. You could look at it as However, the books are cleaned. It's a lot like the year of Jubilee for land. There's periods of time, and you may die before the high priest does. So there's no guarantee you're ever going to make it back home to see the things you left behind. But nonetheless, that's what it is. And so the cities are picked. Who does this law apply to? What determines whether you're eligible, whether you're under the law of death for murder, or you can go to the city? What makes that applicable to you? Are you in the borders of Israel? If you're in the borders of the land, doesn't matter if you're a sojourner or who you are, justice in God's eyes is still the same. And this is the plan he has put together for them as a nation. God didn't wait for them to develop their own laws to start with. He gave them to them, didn't he? They're still living under the covenant. They're still subject to the Ten Commandments and the other sundry laws that are listed about how to handle disputes and thievery and all kinds of things. And he's added this one as a specific one about how to handle and mete out justice when a life is taken. And so God has laid the foundation for their justice system in this particular area going forward. Questions, thoughts, comments?
When yes. He's in the city of refuge, do they appoint him a job, or what does he do while he's there?
I don't know, but I'll tell you what, if I was in the city of refuge and they said, you know, while you're here, we think you need to do this, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do what it takes to be in good graces in the city of refuge, but I have no idea how they specifically would handle it.
When has the attitudes that you're giving examples of not been the case with humanity?
What?
The word kamikaze before Pearl Harbor is the same attitude.
Well,
Japanese, divine wind.
Yeah, there's a difference, though, and there's a huge difference. And that huge difference is the source of the punishment and the determination of who gets punished. If you want to go back and look at the time of the Japanese, they beheaded lots of people that did nothing but be foreigners.
That's right.
So you can't say this is something that comes up out of mankind, because it just doesn't. So anyway, I mean, that's just kind of, that's the big difference. That's why there's anti-Semitism today, I believe, is the source of where these people came from. All right, well, let's go ahead and look at Joshua chapter 21. And in Joshua chapter 21, another thing that God said was going to happen becomes established. And I'm going to read verses 1 through 10. Then the heads of the households of the Levites approached Eleazar the high priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of households of the tribes of the sons of Israel. They spoke to them at Shiloh in the land of Canaan, saying, "The Lord commanded through Moses to give us cities to live in with their pasture lands for our cattle." So the sons of Israel gave the Levites from their inheritance these cities with their pasture lands according to the command of the Lord. Then the lot came out for the families of the Kohathites and the sons of Aaron the priest, who were the Levites. They received 13 cities by lot from the tribe of Judah and from the tribe of Simeonites and from the tribe of Benjamin. The rest of the sons of Kohath received 10 cities by lot from the families of the tribe of Ephraim and from the tribe of Dan and the half tribe of Manasseh. The sons of Gershon received 13 cities by lot from the families of the tribe of Issachar and from the tribe of Asher and from the tribe of Naphtali and from the half tribe of Manasseh in Bashan. The sons of Merari, according to the families, received 12 cities from the tribe of Reuben and from the tribe of Gad and from the tribe of Zebulun. Now the sons of Israel gave by lot to the Levites these cities with their pasture lands, as the Lord had commanded through Moses. They gave these cities, which are here mentioned, by the name from the tribe of the sons of Judah and from the tribe of the sons of Simeon. And they were for the sons of Aaron, and one of the families of the Kohathites, and the sons of Levi, for the lot was theirs first. And this chapter continues to talk about the specifics of the cities that were handed out. So let's go back. In verse 1, there's a group of people that come up before, really, the ruler council of Israel. They come up before, they are the Levitical family heads. And they come up before Eleazar, the high priest, and Joshua, and the heads of all of the various tribes. So everybody's got their land allotted. And now these folks are bringing up this issue. They do it at Shiloh, which is the base of their base camp for their leadership. And they bring up the command of Yahweh, the command that came through Moses before they ever entered, that they would give cities for the Levites, the priestly group who got no family inheritance, land inheritance in the way that the others were apportioned, but they were to be given cities with pasture lands to take care of their flocks. Go back to Numbers. No, we don't need to go there. I'm just going to tell you. In Numbers chapter 3, we have a census done of the Levitical families, and it covered all males 1 month old and up. So if they were living and at least a month old, they got their head counted, males. And there were 22,000, it said, at that point in time. So how many Levites have to be supported off of the land who didn't get an inheritance? Now, I say off the land. There are also going to be temple gifts brought and sacrifices they get to participate in. But it's not going to be enough to cover all of them, because here's how I made my guess, and it's just a guess. But I'm guessing there were 44,000. If you go to a typical population and you look at the demographics, unless there's some event that interferes, it's pretty close to 50-50. So if you had 44,000 males, you probably had somewhere around 22,000 males, you probably had somewhere around 22,000 females. It's not gonna be exactly 50-50, but that just gives us a guess to say, if we want to visualize what God has taken care of with these cities that are going to be given, I'm guessing somewhere 45,000 plus or minus. Maybe a pretty good percentage. So these folks have no inheritance. Up to this point, they don't have a place to call home. They don't have a place to take care of their flocks. And so this is the plan for them. And there's really no argument. But in verse 3, it says they begin to give lands to them. Who determined what land they got? Well, that's a tricky question. Who determined what cities were available? Let's say that first. Look there at verse 3. Who determined what cities were offered up to the Levites? No. Excuse me? Well, it was a command of the Lord, but somebody had to say which cities it was going to include. The sons of Israel. In other words, the leadership took the responsibility and they selected cities spaced out in the new land, and the handout I gave you today shows our best guesses on where all of these cities were. And so they said, okay, here's the cities they can have. How did they determine how many? I don't know. But they determined these cities. There are 48 of them, if you read down through the whole chapter. And they also got not only the city itself, but back in Numbers 31, they said they also get pastures around the city, outside the city wall, for 1,000 cubits outward in every direction. So they got pasture land around the outside of the city wall for their flocks. By the way, you've already got my last color print in here. My printer died. Now I'm in black and white. That's neither here nor there. But this was black and white anyway. So they gave them these cities to have. Now, who determined Who got which cities? How did they determine that?
Then the lot came out, the family, so by lot.
They went back to letting God decide through the process of casting lots. And so that is the process that was used for doing that. And so that resulted in the Levites having their cities to make their individual home bases out of, and to sustain their flocks, to take care of their families and so on. We've got some more we're going to look at here in 21, but first of all, any questions or comments about that part of it, the allotting of the cities?
On the map where you have Levitical cities, all of the cities of refuge, are they included in the Levitical cities? Or
no.
Are they just showing the star and that's...
There are some that cover both.
Okay.
There was one map, and this wasn't it. I don't think. I'm looking real hard to see if it... There one was map that showed also a city of refuge, but not all the cities of refuge became Levitical cities.
This one is by stars.
Yeah. What's that?
They're stars.
Okay, they're the stars? Thank you. Okay, good. Thanks for your help with that.
City of refuge,
Golan's on here. That's one of them up there in East Manasseh. It's got a star beside it. And I don't believe, but it looks like maybe all of them are shown, but they're not all cities of Levitical cities as well, I don't believe. I might be wrong in that. I didn't go out and try to match them up for sure one way or the other. Another map I looked at had them distinguished a little differently than this map does. And when I was looking at that map, my memory of it was there were some that were dual and some that weren't. Let's go down and look at verses 43 through 45. There's some things worth making comment about down there. And this is after they're all the information is given about the cities. We read this beginning in verse 43. So the Lord gave Israel all the land which he had sworn to give their fathers, and they possessed it and lived in it. And the Lord gave them rest on every side according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and no one of all their enemies stood before them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hand. Not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. All came to pass. And so this is kind of a summary statement, but God is saying this through the writer of the book of Joshua to say, Yahweh, I, God, gave Israel everything I had promised. They've got it. I kept my word to their fathers. And when it says, as sworn to their fathers in the New American Standard, in our understanding, we ought to be thinking covenant. God made a covenant that goes clear back to Abraham. It goes actually back to Abram by name, if you want to go that far. It was restated through Isaac and then restated through his interactions through Moses. And so he gave them all the land. They possessed it. They lived in it. But it doesn't say there weren't any of the Canaanites left. They had it. And they had peace. And they had the ability, they had the opportunity, if they had wanted to obey God's command to clear the land out. But that's not said here, and they didn't choose to do that. And it says he gave them rest on every side. So here they are, the Israelites have just conquered this area and done it in fairly short order, the southern kingdom in particular. The battle for the southern part that would later become called Judah, they went through that like lightning. They were very quick. And why? God was fighting with them. And then they took the rest of the land, and God was still fighting with them. And we know that because not one enemy stood before them, but here is the reason why. Why did there still not one enemy standing before them? It says it right here. I know, these are the Sunday school answers, but we got to take note of it or we read right by it. Because God had given them their enemies. Israel will play the fool to an extent. In this way, they get proud. They think they're mighty. They fail to recognize that they are mighty, but not mighty in and of themselves. They needed to learn from Paul, but he wasn't there to tell him that God's strength is found in human weakness. And they didn't see it. So yes, there was no enemy standing before them. And it wasn't because the Israelites were great, it was because Yahweh was great. Yahweh will even say, I didn't pick you because you were great, I picked you because you're the least. I wanted to glorify me, not you. That's essentially what he's saying. And so he gave it to them in their hands. Verse 45, not one of the good promises made by Yahweh to the house of Israel failed. All the promises that he made to them about taking the land were fulfilled. Today, I hear it. Sometimes I even voice it myself to my own shame. It's easy to have fears. It's easy to fear how things are going to turn out. It's easy to look at the world and go, it's crashing. It's easy to look at the war in Iran and go, was this wise? How's this going to turn out? What's the end going to be? It's easy to look at people who have limited wisdom and knowledge and understanding that are providing, making decisions and providing leadership and go, this can never work. I saw a sign for the first time yesterday. Not yesterday, Friday, that traveling up the turnpike to Topeka is just, it just made me wonder what in the world's going to happen now. Very simple sign, all words. God made trans people. Big billboard. Yeah, he also made pedophiles and murderers. I'm sorry. Where are we going to draw the line? God made the people that are trans today. God didn't force them or make them to be trans. And we can go down that list. Where is human accountability gone? It doesn't exist. It's easy to have fear about that. But when we have fear about it, what are we saying? Trust of God is becoming hard to find. And yet, where has God ever let down his people? Does he always save his people from attempted genocide and murder? No. No, you and I may experience all kinds of evil at the hands of man. It doesn't move us out of the kingdom of God. In preparing for the lesson today, I tried to find some example somewhere where it talked about an individual going to a city of refuge for the purpose by which it was established. I couldn't find any. But in the course of doing that, one of the things I did was a word study on the term refuge. And I think it fits into what we've been talking about here at the end. I'm not going to have time for all of them, but this one you got to do. Psalm 2, verses 1 through 12. Psalm 2, verses 1 through 12. This fits in with a similar theme, not the exact theme, that was in the video you watched a few weeks ago about prophecy. We're going to read 1 through 12. I can't get there. We are. What did I do wrong? Oh, no, we're right. We're right. Let me read Psalm 2, 1 through 12. Why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Then he will speak to them in his anger and terrify them in his fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. Surely I will tell of the decrees of the Lord, the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have been begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give you the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. Now, therefore, O king, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoicing with trembling. Do homage to the Son, that he may not become angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath may soon be kindled. How blessed are all who take refuge in him. What is that psalm about? That's Christ. It describes the world perfectly today. He talks about the nations being in uproar, peoples devising vainness, kings of the earth taking their position, and rulers counseling together against the Lord God. And he says, but take refuge in my Son. And by the way, be careful, all of you that are scoffing, don't make him mad. That's what it says. I'm going to skip and do one more real quick. I know we're out of time. I'm skipping Psalm 34 and Psalm 46, but there's one New Testament time that, at least in the New American Standard, got translated refuge. And I want to go there. Hebrews 6, 17 through 20. Hebrews 6, 17 through 20. The book of Hebrews is all about the Jews and that have become Christians and their secret or maybe not so secret desire to go back and be Jews again because of the status they held and the life they were used to. And in the book of Hebrews, the writer is saying, you're trading the very lesser, you're trading away the very great to get one that is very lesser and insufficient. In verse 17, it says this, in the same way, God, desiring even more to show the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. This hope we have as an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil, where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. The transition from the promises of God in the Old Testament, which were great and good and fully dependable, have become magnified indescribably in the New Testament, meaning within Christ. And Christ is our refuge. And our refuge is not from mankind that would put me to death because of an earthly law. Our refuge is from God himself and what I deserve as an eternal punishment from God. And in Christ I have refuge because Christ paid that sin debt for me. And so God can be both just and justifier. Questions, comments? Yes, sir.
Yeah, a few comments. What is all six cities of refuge were? Levitical cities?
They were? Okay, thank you.
That's actually very, very important for the wisdom and justice of God. So they were run by Levites or priests who occupied. So let's say you were a man from Judah, you were equal, and you killed an Ephraimite. And your nearest city was a refuge was an Ephraim.
Might need that priest to stick up for you.
Might not get too fair a trial.
That's right.
Especially considering how strong the tribal bonds were. Your chance of getting a fair trial were minimal. So that's a huge thing. And I think probably maybe the most interesting story in the Bible regarding the City of Refuge is the story of Joab and Abner. Joab was a general in David's army. Abner was a general in Saul's army. And Abner made peace with David. But Abner had also killed Asahel, who was Abner's brother. So Abner fled to Hebron, City of Refuge. Joab goes there and lures him outside the city gate and kills him.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about that.
The City of Refuge.
Yep. Well, apparently they just didn't use the word refuge or a few other things I looked for me to fill in my gaps of knowledge. But yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up, Dave. And it's pretty amazing because there's hundreds of years between the establishment of those cities and the time of David. And they're still abiding by the process. And even in that bit of deception, he wasn't going to kill him inside the City of Refuge.
You kind of alert to, and I don't know if I caught everything you said, so I don't know if you mentioned it often. Jesus Christ is our city.
That's right.
A refuge. So he's not a Levite, he's after the order of Melchizedek from the tribe of Judah. He is our city.
He's a better priest.
Yep.
It's an Old Testament type of Christ.
Yeah, I hurried through that piece in Hebrews, but that's where it basically lays that out very clearly. Very good. Thank you, David. That really helps. Anybody else? All right, we'll see you next time.